I'm sitting here with Emily Ford from Oak and Laurel Cemetery Preservation, LLC. Welcome. For this year, you did a long historical analysis of All Saints Day, which for 2015 was Sunday, November 1st, and today is November 2nd, which is All Souls Day. So the years that you had looked into were pretty significant ones. The most recent year that you profiled was All Saints Day
1945.
Oh, it was 1945. That was the war one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're both World War ones, but yeah. Yes. 1945, World War II. Mm-hmm.
So this is after World War II has been won.
Just barely after.
And in your blog, you mentioned that there's a scarcity of bed sheets for children's costumes.
Somehow everybody made it through.
Right. But that's kind of forgotten. And what you are dealing with today in cemetery preservation is more how war technologies were brought to the consumer. Can you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. 1945, I mean, some of the specific things I saw that were advertised were rock-tight cement paint, which I have to say specifically was a revelation for me, because I've had to remove that cement paint, and I remember wondering, like, geez, this is like cement, but it's paint, and it's terrible. It's very hard. A lot of these other things, latex paint, Portland cement-based concrete, a lot of these were really great for new technology, but were bad for softer historic materials like lime and our New Orleans brick, which is very, very soft. And it traps moisture against the walls of tombs. It can cause brick to deteriorate. It can cause enormous structural problems because it's very heavy. And really all of this started after 1945, when these materials became popularly available as the product of wartime technology.
So listeners might not be as familiar with how to take care of a tomb, because it's not really something that people do anymore. But in 1945, there were visitors to the cemeteries on All Saints Day, and they were cleaning their tombs and they were taking care of it. Can you say a little bit about that?
About 1945? I mean, I would take issue, like, people do come and take care of their graves now. We still have a lot of people who visit their cemeteries, and really more than I would even say than there has been in the past 25 years, simply because people get more into genealogy these days. They get more connected with their families, so they are out there caring for their tombs. 1945, there's a lot more of a significance to that, because it's prior to the 60s, where we see a lot of population movement. Everybody who lived in New Orleans in 1945 had generations of family buried there. So there was a deeper connection to the cemeteries, where in the 1960s we see a total disconnect, and a lot of bad things that happened after that. But 45, people are out there painting, they're dropping off chrysanthemums, they're worrying about their family members who died overseas and whether or not their remains will be brought home. It's a very significant year for a lot of things.
Okay, the year that you did next was 1918.
1918, yeah.
Significant because of World War One, but there are two other points that you talk about, which would be, and I want to read this quote out loud. You mentioned chrysanthemums were a flower of mourning. In 1918, the floral world will not be outdone by human beings. It would appear and is plunged in the midst of one of the most widespread outbreaks of disease in history of local greenhouses, followed out the example by human beings as closely as possible. So that was chrysanthemums. They were going for an equivalent to like $100 or $150.
Twice as expensive as roses.
And the widespread outbreaks of disease that is referenced in this quote from the Times-Picayune from October 27th of 1918, the outbreaks of disease they refer to is
the chrysanthemums.
No, but what are they talking about for humans?
Oh, well, they're talking about the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, which at this point was actually more present in people's mind than the war itself. 1918, World War One in general, like, people didn't really see the carnage and what these soldiers went through until they returned home, mostly in 1919. November 1918, we were still at war. So what was more significant than the war and was so much more present in everybody's day-to-day life was that the influenza epidemic, which in November, the state legislature actually banned gatherings of close crowds of people in order to prevent the spread of flu, because they didn't know how it spread. And people were worried that they couldn't even go out to the cemeteries in 1918, for fear of catching flu.
So the whole month of October in 1918, church services were, stopped. Yeah. It wasn't allowed.
Mm-hmm. And movies and movie theaters too.
But they did get an announcement that they were able to do church services on All Saints Day, and people did go out to the cemeteries.
They did. They did. They noted, in newspapers, I believe, that, it was a little bit less of a presence than usual, mostly because people were still afraid of, catching flu, but people were, present in the cemeteries in 1918.
And you found a really great epitaph from Lafayette Cemetery Number 1. Do you want to read it?
Oh, it's Grayson Hewitt Brown. He's on the main aisle of Lafayette Cemetery Number 1. And it's a tomb that has not really seen a lot of maintenance in the past, but the epitaph has always captured me, and it says, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." And Grayson Hewitt Brown, I mean, it's obvious he died in 1918, and I think a lot of people see that date and assume that he died in France at war. And he actually died in Pineville, Louisiana, while he was at boot camp during an outbreak of spinal meningitis, where he heroically helped his friends who were infected with the meningitis, and he caught it himself and died a few days later. Mm-hmm. Oh, and he—I didn't notice it. I didn't mention it in the blog, but his parents actually took his last paycheck and donated it to the Washington Artillery as a patriotic gesture. It was a big deal for his folks.
That's sweet. So going earlier into your blogs, let's see. I'm trying to get my notes up. I really liked this part. So you next profiled 1878, which is also a year that saw a huge death toll from the yellow fever epidemic. So this one, again, was health officials cautioned against the tradition of All Saints Day. But you have this quote I want to read. "The humanistic purpose of the holiday, to share in mourning as a community, held deep roots in this year. In each cemetery, reports described strangers consoling bereaved parents and children and neglected graves decorated by passersby. Militias visited tombs of fallen comrades, those who had fallen in their battle against the yellow scourge. More than ever, orphan asylums harboring the surviving victims of the epidemic stood post at each cemetery collecting donations." Can you speak a little bit more to mourning as a community?
In 1878, I mean, we hear a lot about yellow fever epidemics in the 19th century in New Orleans. And a lot of times people will be like, oh, 1853 was the worst epidemic ever, which is true in terms of percentages. However, you're talking about a population of tens of thousands versus a population of hundreds of thousands. And 1878 was easily, for the country as a whole, the worst epidemic on record. And this is, you know, a time where people were literally dying in the streets. And there are a lot of different documentations of people helping strangers being, you know, present in this very, very visible death. And the concept of All Saints Day in itself, the concept of All Saints Day is that communal recognition that, you know, the pain that I feel in mourning is the pain that you feel in mourning, and we're going to do this together, and this is one way that we're going to process the grieving of our loved ones. And I think that's why the holiday has endured the way that it has, and 1878 is a great example of that, because it's the recognition of this common grief and this common need to get through it.
In 1878, it was kind of the beginning of there being photos of people, right? And there was like a a trend in photographing the dead, right? On Canal Street?
I don't know about Canal Street, actually. Postmortem photographs are definitely a thing for the 1870s, especially. It was common. They actually sold specialized harnesses in which you could stand a corpse up in a position with which to photograph them. We see a lot of those. I've actually... last year I saw an art piece that used a postmortem photograph of an infant, and I think that perhaps they didn't realize that that was what it was. But yeah, it was a very common thing. And honestly, if you were a photographer, you were probably doing postmortem photographs.
Wow. So another thing that I like from your blog of 1878, that's the one with the photographs.
Yeah.
So you offered, so this is like a bigger... blog post because it has more photographs in it. It takes descriptions from some of the New Orleans cemeteries that newspaper reporters would go to each of the cemeteries and write about All Saints Day and write about like what was going on, you know, what was like the new parts of the cemeteries. And there also were new cemeteries then. And they would just talk about the different decorations and everything. So you share a different, for each cemetery, not all of the New Orleans cemeteries, but for some of them, you show a picture of what they are today and a description of, from the newspapers of the day. And in every single one of them, there are oak avenues and like beautiful landscaping, which is completely absent from today's photos. There's also just a great level of disrepair. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. Difference? Those documentations from All Saints Days in the past, and they kind of drop off around the 20s where people are just assuming everybody knows. Well, people are assuming that people are taking photographs of the cemeteries. It's not so necessary to describe the cemeteries very, you know, in detail. But these descriptions...
I feel like I should give an example description.
Sure.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I just don't think that it's all that common an experience for listeners to like... think about reading in a newspaper about All Saints Day, you know? So this one is from the Daily Democrat, and it is talking about St. Vincent de Paul, which is on Louisa Street. And the quote is, "This cemetery is undoubtedly one of the most beautiful in New Orleans. Visitors there will become enamored with death. Roses and violets, cypresses and mournful pines adorn the sad scene, contending with each other for supremacy. There, the soft magnolias blow, and by the side of a humble grave with a white marble slab, magnificent mausoleums can be seen, of which Queen Artemisia would be proud." So can you tell us about the descriptions and today?
Well, in the case of St. Vincent de Paul, St. Vincent de Paul is a really great example because for so many reasons, these descriptions are really the only thing that we have to understand what these cemeteries would have looked like historically. There's actually not a ton of photographs and most of them are not indexed. So these are enormous resources, but St. Vincent de Paul is really special. One, because I love the cemetery very much. It's one of my favorites, but also because a 1974 definitive book of New Orleans cemeteries declared St. Vincent de Paul Cemetery as having no structures of architectural value, and totally writing this cemetery off.
That's 1974.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's very easy for us to look at these cemeteries and assume that what we're seeing is at all historically appropriate. It's not. And St. Vincent de Paul now, you know, in contrast to this 1878 documentation of, you know, lush trees and cypresses, magnolias, now St. Vincent de Paul has absolutely no greenery at all. And that really has a lot to do with those 1945
Portland cement.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you know what? It's really hard to cut the grass in cemeteries and nobody likes to do it. So once it becomes popular, you know, for people to lay down cement, to keep the grass from growing. It's so much easier to keep the trees from growing because, you know, they're going to be a nuisance. Somebody has to spend money to keep them in healthy. All of those things were removed. And I mean, that's even the case for, say, St. Louis Cemetery number 1, where even if you look in 1968's Easy Rider footage from that movie, you can see grass, trees, things like that. Between 68 and now, all of that's been removed and it's pretty much all cement paving.
Yeah. Not good for water flow.
No. And then we see a lot of different like documentation in the past, say 30 years, where all historic preservation, like assessments of the cemetery is like, oh, well there's drainage problems. And yeah, that's not a surprise at all because pretty much there's no permeable surface in the cemeteries any longer.
Mm. Can we read this quote here from this is again, the Daily Democrat. This one was from All Souls Day, November 2nd, 1878. We feel impelled to pay a tribute of condolence to the many bereaved ones, whose hands have yesterday carried flowers to bedeck newly closed tombs. To fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, the whole human family indeed that resides in our midst, we offer our heartfelt sympathies and beg them to remember that Providence is inscrutable in its designs, but infinite in its mercy. You know, I was, even today, just trying to find like words of grief for thinking about people who have passed that are close to me this year. And, I mean, there were like some very simple phrasing that I thought was really nice. I almost even went to the library to get a like death book for children to try to find like words to think about it. But yeah, it's just not as handy, this language to talk about condolences and grief today, than it might have been. And that quote was 1878. You know, it's just, it's not as public death.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, something that I've talked about a lot in the past as well is, you know, there's a point at which, and it's honestly in the 1940s when, yeah, I mean, it's happened a little bit before then too, but like really by the 1940s, there's this industrialization of the death industry, which it is, it's an industry. And all of a sudden people aren't physically intimate with death. You know, people are not dying in their homes. They're dying in hospitals. People are not being waked or even people used to be embalmed in their kitchens. There used to be tables with which people were, the embalmer would show up and remains would be embalmed in the home in which they died. Funerals very seldom actually occur in cemeteries anymore. We're very disconnected from the reality of death, which is really ironic considering it's the one thing that we will all without a doubt have to deal with. And I think it's very, in the late 19th century, that intimacy was completely, it was a very different expression of, we interacted with each other so much more, I would want to say honestly, but openly with the reality of death. And I mean, we can say that that's because in the 1870s, people were acutely aware of the fact that anybody could die very easily anytime. I think it also just has to do with a different level of community that people were willing to engage with. People were willing to mourn openly.
Yeah, I want to kind of link into the next blog post, which was from 1853.
Oh, 65. No, I'm sorry.
Okay, 1865. Mm-hmm. So at this time, a lot of people in New Orleans had not received the bodies of their family members who might have died in the Civil War. And I wanted to play this quote from the American Experience, Death in the Civil War.
Back at the front, men, soldiers on the line, officers, civilians who followed the armies, and eventually families who went looking for their dead loved ones, see the carnage of war, the dismembering of bodies, and the loss of bodies, the loss of identities altogether. Could you even find Johnny if you went to the front to find him? Very often the answer was no.
I'm going to stop there. So this was a really difficult year for experiencing shared grief and celebrating All Saints Day. Can you sum up a little bit what it looked like during the Civil War this time?
Well, during the Civil War, I think it was a lot different than right after the Civil War, which was what All Saints Day 1865 was just about a few months of. It was surrender was in the spring, and All Saints Day was in the fall. But during the Civil War, the newspapers documented that there wasn't really a lot of folks in the cemeteries because honestly, people weren't being returned. Like, remains weren't being returned. If you had a loved one who died in the trenches at, say, Petersburg or Bull Run or any given battle, or even if they died in a camp upriver, or if they were, you know, shot in the shelling of Baton Rouge, it was pretty unlikely that you were going to be able to inter his remains. The Civil War was not necessarily a modern war in the way that we see it now, but it was the first modern war of what modern war was then. And, there was really no plans in place for how they would return remains, if they even bothered to, And it was very difficult for these people, especially in New Orleans, which was occupied very early on in the war, to actually have a lot more access to federal soldiers who had died than the Confederate soldiers who had died, you know, mm-hmm. who were from the city. Not to say that there weren't federal soldiers from New Orleans, which there were, but... on all sides, it was very difficult there to recover remains if there ever was. I mean, I myself have an ancestor who died at Shiloh who was never marked. And that's the case for a lot of folks. Burial places were just not given priority in the chaos of war.
But also the chaos of war was visible because people did in the years after go out to the battlefields. And Clara Barton had tried to get people returned or mm-hmm. bodies returned. Home to be, you know, properly mourned. But really what people found on battlefields was gore.
It exposed remains for a very long time. And this really does speak to that larger, just base human need to give dignity to the dead that pretty much, I mean, there was an enormous effort, not from the top down, not from the government to identify these remains and get them back to their families, but from the bottom up, from the soldiers who died alongside these guys. I didn't write about it in the blogs, but you know, in a similar way, the first Memorial Day is exactly that. The first Memorial Day, there's conflicting stories about how Memorial Day started, but one of the larger narratives is that this happened in Charleston, South Carolina, at a racetrack that had been a prison for federal soldiers. And in 1868, when they, you know, the people, they honestly hadn't even been buried appropriately there by that point, a great number of freed slaves actually went to this racetrack and spent the entire day celebrating these people who had fought for them freedom, marking their graves, decorating their graves, and celebrating them. And that was the first Memorial Day. I mean, this is a base thing that people need is to bury our dead. I mean, that's how we identify civilizations. Hmm.
Okay, so the first year that you had profiled in your blogs was, I didn't write it down, 1853. Yeah. So another yellow fever epidemic. This is the earliest profile you did. Can you just paint a picture of what the decorations were, what the event was?
1853 is, I see it in my own mind being so familiar with the cemeteries. I know what architecture remains from then. And, the cemeteries would have been, honestly, they would have been spectacular. They would have been, just chock full of Italian marble because it was cheaper than domestic marble at the time. Really high classical Greek revival styles. I mean, we see some of this still, but like to see a cemetery of nothing but that would have been
truly amazing. We really don't realize how much we've lost. There's no way to understand just what that would have been. But, and also, you know, this is like the beginning of what David Sloan would call the beautification of death period. So people are decorating with crepes. So black paper, immortelles, which are delicately beaded wreaths, which actually it was a little bit early for this, but, later on people would have been using wreaths that were made of human hair. But the really delicate, pieces of craft work. And in 1853, this is honestly the last time they really mention it. They were burning candles all night, People, All Saints Day was described in 1853 as being a primarily nighttime event where things actually really didn't kick off until midnight, when everybody lit candles and stayed in the cemetery all night. So obviously, you know, the intensity of the holiday has waned. You know, the people aren't doing this. This does happen in some of the upriver parishes still, where people will burn candles all night. But it would have been absolutely spectacular. It would have been very, very sad, but it would have been truly something we can't conceive of now.
All right. So to just kind of cap up the conversation, I guess could you maybe talk to us a little bit about, you had referred me to
Philippe Ariès.
Sorry.
Philippe Ariès, is pretty simple. It's in a simple way to explain a 900-page book. He was a French anthropologist who in the 1970s wrote a book called The Hour of Our Death, which really covered about 1,000 years of death culture, dealing with the way that we would bury underneath churches, to, you know, moving cemeteries out to the exterior of town. And it's really amazing because the way that he, I mean, what we see is so unique about New Orleans cemeteries, when you really get down to it, is not. We participated in a larger arc of transition of death culture with pretty much everybody else in the Western world. That book really nails down, a lot of things that you really can't see with the naked eye. There's other books also, David Sloan, The Last Great Necessity. And there's another book called The American Way of Death that kind of deals with this kind of lightly as well.
Right. So the conversation about death is something that's kind of recurring after having been, you know, kind of silenced, right? So we had industrialization. We've also had, you know, the death industry, but also the medical industry really sanitizing what it means to leave our living bodies, and also what it means to mourn those who do, our loved ones. And when we reflect on today, we have something to look forward to. We have people participating in death salons, which is like really just talking.
Yeah, it's just a larger venue through which people can discuss their feelings of death in a safe place where, you know, there's not any immediate concern of seeing, you know, mourning as a sign of weakness or, as being a conversational faux pas, which I think a lot of people deal with, when they're mourning, they feel like they can't express themselves. So yeah, there's a great deal going on in the States now, that does kind of not necessarily reverse, but at least transition into the next phase of mourning culture.
So I want to end on a positive note. Can you tell me what your dreams are for New Orleans cemeteries?
Yes, I can. I absolutely can. I
wait,
wanna...
we don't have an hour and a half, though.
I want to see, there are so many resources in New Orleans available for people who have families buried in these cemeteries. I think a lot of times the neglect we see in cemeteries is not because people don't want to care for their tombs. It's just because they don't know how, or they don't know how to reconnect with their ancestors buried in these cemeteries. I want to see so much more resources that will empower tomb owners and cemetery stakeholders, so including the cemetery owners, to take a stance of historic preservation and make it a larger cultural goal than it has been in the past. I want to see more resources for cemetery owners themselves so that they can manage cemeteries in ways that are more in tune with historic preservation ethics, which is actually not as difficult as I think they think they might be. And I do want to see a lot more participation in things like All Saints Day. For a short period of time, I thought about putting together something like an elder helper program where some of the older folks who end up taking care of their tombs on All Saints Day are paired with somebody who wants to learn more about it. Because that's really what these things have been in the past. We talked about it in 1878 where the stranger decorated the neglected grave. We still can do that, and I think that we still get a lot of, as humans, we still get a lot of reward as humans in doing that. I think that all of those things are very possible in the next decades in New Orleans.
Thank you for talking to us. If you want to read the blogs, you can go to www.oakandlaurel.com. All of the blogs are listed there. There's some other content that's really great. Emily made a really awesome JPEG that has really simple ways for taking care of your tomb in a really respectful way. There's also a couple of blog posts about New Orleans brick. You had mentioned it's really soft. And it's also something that I think when we take walks or we're driving around, we really do admire some of the brickwork here. So there's a two-part essay on that. Again, this is Emily Ford talking to us with WTUL News and Views, and you can visit her website at www.oakandlaurel.com. Emily is part of Oak and Laurel Cemetery Preservation, LLC.
Thank you so much for having me.